This is a download from the BBC. To find out more and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts. The media show is presented by Paddy O'Connell.
Thanks very much. Hello and welcome. I am Paddy, in for Steve Hewlett today. Long mocked as male, pale and stale, the broadcasters today launch a new diversity plan. Should we sell shares in straight white men? We test the link between a celebrity sex tape and press freedom. We hear how street gangs here at home were given cameras to film themselves for a new TV series, and how those news people switched off Brexit.
This is Sky News Live in Westminster. The Prime Minister resigns after the UK votes to leave the European
Union. And turned on to Olympic gold instead.
Basking in glory, Team GB reflect on a wonderful night in Rio with Britain's golden couple of cycling leading the way.
Do journalists seem to run in a herd or else go on holiday at the same time? Rod Liddell and Peter Hitchens swap their sun loungers for this sunny studio. TV rivals today launch a joint scheme to monitor diversity after years of being mocked as pale, male and stale. From big-name actors and presenters to the people who put them there on the screen, all will be asked to contribute to the same system monitoring ethnicity, disability, sexual identity and more. It's a flagship act of cooperation. But how this data will be used or shared is already contested. The trade union BEC2 wants more transparency, and all of us who've ever filled out a form will wonder, if the Pentagon can't protect information, is the answer really someone working in TV? The boss of the whole thing, called Diamond, is Amanda Ayres, Executive Director of the Creative Diversity Network, and she explained why the scheme is necessary.
Both on screen and off screen, we need to get a more diverse workforce. And the main reason for doing that is that diversity is about creativity and innovation. If we want to have the best possible TV industry we can, we need to draw on the talents of every section of the population.
But are you basically trying to airbrush away those straight white men?
Not at all. What we're doing in launching Diamond is measuring the diversity of the whole workforce. So we're not just looking to count disabled people or ethnic minority people. We're looking to look at the whole workforce of the industry just to see how different groups of people are distributed across different areas of work.
And you've come up with a very large scheme, it seems to me, a template shared across all genres. Will every single production be asked to give staff the chance to contribute?
Yes, we're asking every programme that's commissioned by the four broadcasters who are part of Diamond, that's BBC, Channel 4, ITV and Sky, and we'll be looking at the diversity of the on-screen and off-screen workforce. We're also going to be looking at diversity as viewers would see it. So this is genuinely a first, really, for television in the UK.
It's got the whiff of the sort of scale of cooperation of the TV leaders' debate. I mean, it's a big deal to get all these people who often hate each other to do this. But so let's talk about the information. As a viewer, will I be able to see it all?
We're still deciding exactly what the best format for reports is going to be.
So no, it sounds like I won't be able to see it all.
But we will definitely be publishing reports that show the picture by broadcaster, by genre, by area of work. What we're still looking at is how detailed can we get. People will be able to compare different broadcasters. They'll be able to compare factual programming with drama or comedy. And they'll be able to look at different areas of the workforce. So we'll be able to look at diversity of people working in camera, different presenters and so on.
So, Amanda, you've described a really big sweep of getting the information. Can you tell me how you're going to use it all once you get it?
Absolutely. We'll be using the information to make sure that we've got the right strategies in place for increasing diversity in the industry. We'll be using it to see where are the areas where we're making good progress, what can we learn from those, and I hope we'll also be able to use it to identify if broadcasters have got particular initiatives in place to increase diversity in a particular area of the workforce. We can look at whether those initiatives are actually achieving their goals and the targets that broadcasters are setting are being met.
Of course, interestingly, BEC2's criticism is you're not going to be transparent enough. You won't allow me to publicly say the one show has one person in this category. You're going to protect the individual productions more than BEC2 wants you to do. I'm reading Jerry Morris's complaints.
Well, we're always going to have information that can't be published because we can't publish any information that would identify an individual. The Data Protection Act's really clear that we mustn't publish information that on its own or taken with other information in the public domain could allow an individual to be identified. So we always have to withhold data on those grounds. We are still working on exactly what the final format of those reports will be. So I think as Diamond develops, we'll be able to publish more and more detailed information.
Finally, all of us who contribute any information to companies, banks, the government, we all know it's going to be nicked by a teenager with a memory stick. It's going to happen to you. Are you going to take responsibility personally when it is flogged at a train station?
We've taken many steps to make sure that the system is as safe as possible. As soon as an individual enters their data, it is automatically encrypted and it remains encrypted. So nobody within the broadcasting industry can see data about individuals. We've also had the system tested by independent security experts to make sure that it's as safe as it can possibly be before we go live.
And the goal is a TV screen that looks more like our country, looks and sounds more like our country.
Absolutely. What we want is a workforce in which all sections of the community are represented and for viewers to be able, of all kinds, to be able to see themselves represented on screen.
Amanda Harris on a scheme that launches today. Have you spotted, like us, that for weeks on the front pages and here on the radio, the top news has been all Olympics, all medals, all the time?
BBC Five Live.
Oh, all that gold. It's El Dorado. Good morning. Olympic breakfast with Nicky
Team
Campbell.
GB have beaten their own target by winning 50 medals at the Rio Olympics.
The Prime Minister chooses Manchester to hold a homecoming parade for Britain's Olympic medal winners.
Team GB reflects on its most successful Olympics in more than a century as the Rio Games come to an end.
Well, now, this was all in stark contrast to the top news since June the 23rd, which for weeks has been all Brexit all the time.
Cameron resigns as Britain votes to leave the European Union.
I'm Jane Hill at Westminster, as a new political landscape is forming.
Tonight, we are live with Channel 4 News for 90 minutes. Britain adrift amid the most serious constitutional crisis.
Tonight, with big question marks over the leadership of both our major parties, we'll have all the latest.
So how was Brexit beaten to the top spot in the news by hockey, Mo Farah and a dash of Claire Balding? Let's get two gilt-edged guests onto the podium, Peter Hitchens of the Mail on Sunday. Mail Online and Huffington Post. Hello, Peter Hitchens.
Not the Huffington Post, as far as I know.
Oh, well, we've forgive you.
It's the news to me.
We've
but
given you a silver medal there.
Thank you so much.
And Rod Liddell, who edited the Today programme, I'm pretty sure about that, and now at The Spectator and contributed The Sun and Sunday Times. Hello, Rod Liddell.
Hello.
Peter Hitchens, did you spot this switch of the main news and front pages to the Olympics?
Well, I wouldn't call it a switch. I certainly spotted that there was suddenly a huge concentration on the Olympics, with which I personally have a quarrel, because I think that it's overdone. Sport ultimately has no objective importance. It's fun, lots of people like reading about it and watching it and listening to it, but it actually doesn't change anything at all, whereas what's going on, for instance, in Syria at the moment might change a lot of things, but I think it was quite reasonable for the aftermath of the referendum to gradually fade away, since nothing is really happening about it at the moment, or didn't happen
until that
strange aircraft carrier meeting.
Yeah, but that's a story in itself, isn't it? I mean, Britain's got no Brexit strategy. The Prime Minister's on walking poles in Switzerland, and we're talking about diving. I mean, Rod Liddell, you love sport. Did Radio 4 and did the papers, including yours, go giddy on gold?
I think they probably did. I do love sport, but I'm rather sported out this summer, I have to say. But I don't think that that's the main reason that Brexit's taken the back seat. I think the reason that Brexit's taken the back seat is that the calamities which the BBC and everybody else told us would unfold as soon as we decided to leave the European Union simply haven't occurred. And you may say we have, you know, no Brexit strategy, but we have a new Prime Minister in place, and that got plenty of coverage. And we have two other political parties, the Labour Party and UKIP, both having leadership elections. So there's been quite a lot. I mean, unusually for the month of August, there's been no real silly season. There's been sport and there's been all this other stuff taking place, and it's got quite a lot of coverage.
Right. So, Peter Hitchens, do you think it's a welcome relief for many readers?
I think a lot of people probably were tired of it, because the real problem is that we've had the equivalent of a general election. But what didn't happen was the choosing of a new government. The whole policy of the government changed, but we ended up with more or less the same government, Chairman May, replaces David Cameron. Otherwise, nothing much happens.
Yes, they're but then, the we, then we spoke about
and
the
And it
hockey.
Carried on not happening for
but
weeks
after. I understand the Brexit argument, but we've been speaking on the radio. I turn on, the top news is hockey, diving and swimming. And is that OK for the radio and the papers?
Not at the top, no. I don't think so, because there are more important things happening. And Rod has suggested some of them, though I don't agree with him that life is... I'm constantly accused of being a conspiracist about the BBC, but I really don't believe that anybody sat down and said, let's use the Olympics to suppress the fact that all the terrible things we said would happen if we left the European Union haven't happened. I don't think that news works like that. There are conspiracies. They're called lunch, but they can't be that elaborate. But I just don't think that can conceivably be argued. I think a lot of people in the media welcome the Olympics as a chance to find something else to write and broadcast
and
about.
That's...
And quite a lot of readers and viewers probably welcomed it too. There is a huge amount of show business in news coverage, and I think we should never forget that.
And there's a huge amount of knackered journalists and leaders who are tired after all that's happened, Rod Little. There's a lot of people on holiday who work in politics, and they basically handed the baton to the people who work in sport. That's happened, hasn't it?
I think that probably has happened a little bit, although far fewer are on holiday this year than are on holiday in most years. It's usually a rather wonderful time, August. There are stories of spiders and dolphins and usually jellyfish attacking children. There was a sort of half-hearted attempt to get us convinced that there was a wild cat on the prowl in Dartmoor, as there is at this time every single year. But most of the time it has been either sport, which has bored me rigid, apart from on those two occasions when Britain did extraordinarily well, and you could see why that was a lead story. And the rest of it has been politics. And while Peter doesn't agree with conspiracy theories, of course, nor do I. But nonetheless, you know, it's the case that today there was loads of good news about how the economy's doing, about unemployment figures, about house building and so on like that. And that stuff gets relegated.
Oh, for goodness sake, let's not start demanding that the BBC covers good news. It's only in totalitarian countries that broadcasters are compelled to provide good news.
I wonder if that's...
Anyway, how much of it really is good rather than massage statistics?
Well, let me just ask you... No, Rod, I can't really go into Brexit at the moment. I just wonder if you can tell me if what we really need is more of a balance anyway, and that all Brexit all the time is wrong, all Olympics all the time is wrong. Can we please have an omnivorous diet, Peter?
Well, of course we should. And by the way, I completely reject the idea that August is a dull month where we have to cover jellyfish stings. It's what, 25 years ago since I was in Moscow when the tanks rolled down my street for the putsch which ended the Soviet Union. That was August. The First World War began in August. The Second World War very nearly began in August. It's a busy month. And actually, I often don't take holidays during it precisely because it can be so very interesting. But I think there was an overdoing of a lot of aspects of the referendum. There was certainly an overdoing of a lot of aspects of the Olympics, but they're not the same thing. The referendum was about a real issue of power and economics. Medals made of alloy hung on the end of strings don't make any difference to a nation's standing, power, influence or wealth.
And Rod, would you like more of a balance between your precious sport and all the other things that are about our country's future?
Yes, I think so, especially at the time when we've been inundated with the European Championships, which were appalling, and then the Olympics, and then the football season starts. Even for someone who rather likes sport, yes, of course.
I'm amazed at this revelation that Rod likes sport, which he announces between coughs.
Thanks, Peter.
It's a pleasure.
No, I don't think there's a conspiracy about it. I think it really is a case of... We tend not to report good news,
right,
as Peter rightly says,
okay,
you know, as often as we report bad news.
Thank you very much.
And I think that's reasonable.
Thank you. I'm going to end it there because we've only got half an hour. Thank you very much indeed. Listen to Rod Little and Peter Hitchens. And if you're listening at the Huffington Post, Peter may be available. I don't know. Now, if, like me, you're already missing Steve Hewlett, then here he is on tape on a new TV series about violent gangs. Gangland is a two-parter for Channel 5, produced with what's called extensive cooperation of the gangs. And here's a little taste.
Being brought around here, you ain't really got no hope, man.
Geordie first started selling drugs for the gang aged just 13.
My gang was formed because it was right outside my doorstep, and that was my family, that was my brethren. Seeing new shoes, I'm seeing new bikes, I'm seeing new everything. I'm seeing the people pull up over there, the olders, getting the youngers in the cars, and I'm thinking, yeah, I like all this, you understand? And when children start seeing things like this, they think that it's normal, so they can do all these sort of things.
So there they are with their guns, knives and drugs, filmed by themselves. Gangs eat communities,
and it's hard to get the truth. But is this the way to do it? What are the ethics of allowing teenagers to decide what they film? Paul Blake is managing director of Maroon Productions, who've made the series, and Steve spoke to him for today's programme.
I've been interested in the fate of young black men that were just popping up in the page of the Evening Standard, sort of every couple of weeks dead. And so I tried for many years, for about 11 years, to do something about it, to make a film about it, and I was rebuffed at every step, pretty much, but by the broadcasters who told me that it was... it wasn't a story of any interest to the national, a national audience. But anyway,
is that what they were saying? Not of interest.
Yeah, I remember speaking to a well-known broadcaster, and I went to see them, and I said, "Look, at that time, 13 young black men had been shot." And I said, "Well, look, this is not LA. This is not America. This is London. This is outrageous." I said, "Oh, but it's just minor. I can't remember the words that they used, but they just said it was minor." And so we ended up with a spat, and I left the meeting. And then I remember seeing on the commissioning editors, oddly, a pantomime of our kids, and she came up to me and she apologised. She said, "You know, you were right and we were wrong." But anyway, I went back to that broadcast, and they put me in various sorts phases of development to try and do something, but it never went through. And it just kept on going on. The kids kept on dying. It was just... And the thing that really bothered me was that the kids were just kind of faceless. You never knew who they were. You never got a sense of that they were linked to a family, that it was a real loss. And as part of that community, as a someone of Jamaican extraction and a black man, it just hurt me a great deal.
Now, one of the things about this particular series, this two-parter you're doing, it says here in the blurb... It says, much of the film is captured by the gangs themselves at secret locations known only to the gangs. The cameras having been left for the gang members' use in prearranged locations, then returned anonymously by them after filming. Mm-hmm. Now, how comfortable are you with this way of doing things? The reason I ask that is because conventionally one expects the filmmaker, the journalist, to be the person upon whom one relies for some sense of the kind of veracity, if you like, of what we're seeing.
I was very comfortable, actually. I realised that the gangs, I'd spoken to lots and lots of people over the years. I had great contacts as a result of lobbying for such a long time. And the first thing was that they trusted me, but would say, "Well, look, we just can't put our faces out there." And I thought, well, how can we do that? And I realised that if we allowed them to film themselves, to chronicle their lives, that we would get somewhere closer to the truth.
How do you know you've got anywhere near the truth, though? That's the obvious question.
How do I know that we've got close to the truth? First of all, it's a documentary, so it's about it's not a current affairs programme in a sense. So we're not looking at it from a standpoint of, well, look, you tell us, you show us aspects of your life.
Yeah, but you're still making the same claim for it. I know it's not a current affairs programme stylistically, but you're still making the claim that this is a take on reality, as opposed to something that, hypothetically, these characters, and you see them in the film, could be making up for our benefit.
As far as I'm concerned, in terms of the contacts that I had to go through in order to get some of this footage, there's a point of belief, really. I think the first thing we got back was, when we did the dead drop, was a revolver, and they were pointedly loading it with ammunition, with live rounds of ammunition. There were bags of crack cocaine that are liberally scattered around. And there's a point where that material comes back and you've got to take a view. Is it real? And I looked at it, thought, it's real. Let's see what happens next.
Do you know for certain that those people are the real deal?
Do I know for certain? I know for certain I didn't meet them. Because of the contacts I've got in that space, because of the people I've spoken to, I am 100% sure that they are what they say they are, that they are doing what they do.
Why was this not more fully explained in the films? I mean, all you say is that they filmed themselves. Mm-hmm. You don't explain the drop. You don't explain that they had effectively complete editorial control over what they shot, that there was no independent observer there. I just wonder whether you're putting me, the viewer, in a position to judge, really, what I'm seeing.
We had to take a view, really, on the type of film that we wanted to make. Going through and explaining that in every level of detail. There were other things that were happening in that film, in the series, that meant that we had to focus on the stories as they developed. And that's the reason we took that approach. For me, I'm not kind of caught up in the form of how we've made the film. is the fact that we actually made the series. We were filming during a period where people died, very young people died, and that's an incredible thing. I think, you know, we've never seen that before. It's incredibly sad.
One of the people in film two does get stabbed in the end and dies, the musician. Were you concerned at all at any point that in making the film, and not just in this way, but in making this film, you might have played some part in exposing some of the people who talked to you to greater danger themselves?
Not at all. These young people spent a lot of time with them. They were surrounded by that danger way before we appeared. Our presence had no bearing on what happened to any of the people in the film. They live in a space, really, where they themselves have to limit where they go to, where they can go, because it's so dangerous. That's got nothing to do with the fact that we were filming whatsoever.
And just finally, I wonder, just again, what you hope that I, if you like, your average viewer, will take away from this. The reason I ask that is that, you know, I get the message that the kids, that the youngsters, they want money, they want the jet set lifestyle, they want respect, they want status. This is, in one sense, entirely unremarkable. It's the story of human society. It's the story of gangs, wherever they've cropped up in all of human history, as far as I'm aware. What is really distinctive about this particular experience?
I'm thinking about an audience that isn't you, actually. I'm thinking about an audience that isn't as informed, an audience that might read the Daily Mail, the Telegraph, the Sun even, the Daily Mirror, that has no understanding of what's going on in this space at all. They have the culture that the kids that we've been around live in is quite alien to them. And so what I hope we're going to do with this series is actually just allow for the first time those kind of people to sit up and think, well, actually, we had no idea that this was happening. And we as a society need to stop and quite understand them, just because they don't have the same values. They don't have what I call the cricket values, the values of rugby in Middle England, that we shouldn't actually understand why they feel influenced in the and why they're open to this kind of influence in the way that they are. A lot of this is underpinned by drugs and the use of drugs. And as someone said to me a few months ago, every time someone has that glass of Chardonnay on a Friday and that cheeky line of Coke, they should start thinking about their connection to the story.
Paul Blake talking to Steve. You can see the first episode of Gangland next Thursday, the 1st of September, on Channel 5. This is The Last Post. Gawker.com is shutting down today, some 13 years after it began. It is the end of an era. That's what you see, dated Monday, if you look at the gossip website Gawker.com. Right now, Gawker and its editor Nick Denton are embroiled in a court case said to be both the sordid tale of a celebrity sex tape and a direct challenge to press freedom. To explain, we turn to Gawker's former editor Max Reed, now at New York Magazine. I started by asking, what made great Gawker posts?
Gawker started as a media trade gossip blog, basically. So back in 2003, when it was first launched, a great Gawker blog would be Elizabeth Spires, the founding editor, sneaking into the cafeteria at Condé Nast, the enormous magazine publisher, and reporting what she saw. A few years later...
Hang on a minute. That's the sort of Devil Wears Prada movie script that came out later, but that was gossip from inside the big fashion magazines.
Sure, and inside the New York Times, and, you know, all about the changing state of media in 2003, back when things were deteriorating, stuff was moving to the web, but it still wasn't sure how it was all going to shake out.
Passion, rivalry, sex in the media.
Something like that, though, you know, a lot of just very little sort of funny things that people said at parties.
You have written that the sort of spirit of Gawker was having the ability to shoot itself in the foot, even when its foot was in its mouth.
What Gawker had that basically no one else was offering to young and ambitious writers was as close to absolute editorial freedom as could possibly be offered. And a lot of that meant that you made mistakes and you said things that you would later regret, or you overstated your case, or you reported stuff, you know, that you later wished you hadn't. And I think that's one of the things, paradoxically, that made Gawker so appealing. It was a way to really connect with writers on a level you don't normally get.
And that takes us, in a way, to Hulk Hogan, a celebrity wrestler filmed having sex. A DVD comes through the old-fashioned post to Gawker, and they post part of it online. Was the editor right
to do that?
That's sort of above my pay grade. I think that the more apropos question, the more important question is whether or not it was he was legally protected to do so. And in my opinion, he absolutely was. I don't know that anybody now looking at Gawker, which went bankrupt and has now been sold, is saying that the Hulk Hogan tape was so important that they're glad they published it and they wish they had the company. You know, they're happy that the company is gone because of it. The more dangerous idea is that this single, you know, post, this one-off post has now turned into a crisis, an existential crisis for the company.
And it was backed, Hulk Hogan's case, with the help of the billionaire Peter Thiel. And the jury found that Gawker violated his privacy. But you worry about there being more to this than privacy concerns. And it's about billionaires and what they do in court.
Yeah, absolutely. So Peter Thiel came forward earlier this year to announce that he described his funding of Hogan's case against Gawker as the quote was something like the greatest charity work I've ever done. And the problem is when the bottomless pockets of a billionaire get involved in a case this important, such that they can pose an existential threat to a news organization.
So this is an existential story. Gawker is about press freedom and money. So you don't like the way the court case has gone. What is it that seems to you to be punitive about the findings?
Well, I mean, what's punitive is that Gawker was punished to the extent that it was forced out of existence. In particular, the problem is that the judgment that was levied against Gawker, which is $140 million, is about 140 times what the median judgment in wrongful death cases is. $140 million is an enormous amount of money. I mean, it is the amount of money that Gawker can't possibly pay immediately.
And I know you also don't like the fact that there are First Amendment rights to say things that are true, which you wish were upheld. But when you look at it, do you think Gawker can come back? There is an appeal.
Certainly, if it doesn't win on appeal, the judgment's going to get reduced. But this was a particularly unfortunate case where the judge refused to let Gawker continue to operate while undergoing the appeal. She essentially enforced the judgment without allowing the appeal to go through.
And Max, it's easy to see that this is a website that made enemies both in the media and the subjects, and it's easy for me to decide if I back the website or Hulk Hogan. But can you tell me what you think the reaction's been across the media to this case?
I've actually been cheered by how much people have stood up and said, you know, Tina Brown, the famous editor, she tweeted last week, you know, Gawker's made fun of me a lot, but I think it's terrible to see them get killed by a thin-skinned billionaire. Stephen Marsh, the Canadian writer, wrote a New York Times op-ed a little earlier this year. Marsh was a frequent target of mine, in fact, and he wrote a stirring defense and even championing of Gawker as a force for good in the world. I think there will always be people who think Gawker deserved this fate, and I can't do anything about that, but I have been heartened by the number of people who recognize how important even speech you don't particularly like is.
Max Reed. I'm Paddy O'Connell. Thanks for listening. Do join Steve Hewlett back next week, same time, same place.
Thank you for downloading The Media Show. The presenter was Paddy O'Connell, and the producer was Katie Takatsuki. For more information, please go to our website, bbc.co.uk/radio4/mediashow.